chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going this evening, this week, that FTX and so forth. We're going to start off with an interview that Maria Bartiromo had with Art Laufer. And he's going to give us some his insights. He's an economist, quite a well-known and famous, well-known and very successful, I should say. And he's a man to listen to. And he talks about the housing starts and et cetera that have really in shambles. So the housing industry right now is leading us into, he believes, a recession. So here we go with that interview.
Welcome back. October housing starts, building permits coming lower than September. Joining me now to react, former Reagan economic advisor. He is the author of Taxes Have Consequences. Art Laufer is here. Art, great to see you. How do you read this latest detail in terms of economic data, the housing data?
I think Bob Nardelli's comments were right on the mark. I mean, exactly that. This is not good news. This is a harbinger of tough times to come. You know, when you think of it in context, Maria, I mean, we have a very, very low participation rate, which means a labor supply is not there. It just isn't. We have high inflation. We have an economy that's on the brink. And policies, debt, deficits, huge. So to start a downturn at this stage, it's really very depressing and really bad news.
Bob?
Yeah, Art, listen, you've been around this much longer than I have and a lot more experience, but I see those as key negative indicators going forward. So,
yeah, I do too.
Art, tell me this. What are the top one,
what
two?
What do you mean I've been around a lot longer than you, Bob?
I don't think you even know just what joking. You just said. I'm like, wait, what? You've been around this longer than me.
You know, I know I'm
you've
old,
both,
but Methuselah, I'm
no,
not.
No,
you've
I
both
mean,
been around there, Bob Nardelli.
Listen, I'm 74, so I've been around a long time also, sir. I meant your experience. Well, I apologize.
You meant his experience around economics.
Experience around economics.
Guy. He's
you,
an economist.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Wow. Thank you for correcting
we
me.
We all laughed.
So,
the highlight of the show right there.
Yeah, so listen, on.
Oh, my gosh.
Let's focus on the economic side of this for a moment then. And
let's go for it.
Yes, sir. So it seems to me this administration can do a couple of things very, very simply and very quickly to have impact on what's taking place. The only part of the administration that's doing something is the Fed. They're raising rates. So they're taking a hammer-nail approach. You know, the Fed is the hammer, and each of us as consumers are the nails, and they're just pounding us down. But don't you think a change in energy policy, the change at the border, there's a number of things this administration can do immediately to help us turn this thing around?
Yeah, there are, but they're not going to do them, Bob. We're not going to get energy decontrol. I just don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the Fed's going to do what it should do, which is stop price controls, stop trying to control interest rates, let markets determine what interest rates are, and shrink the monetary base or the balance sheet of the Fed. That's what they should do, and they could get that inflation under control. In fact, they could have done that quite some time ago. There's no way this administration is also going to stop spending. So the deficits and the debt levels are going to increase. That's going to happen as well. And when you start all of this with a very low participation rate and a housing market starting to tilt to go really down, which it really is, that's a bad sign for the future of the economy. And it also indicates the severity of the downturn. Now, I believe we are in a secular decline rather than in a recession. I think it's secular, but I think this bodes very poorly for the U.S. economy to come.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Art, it's Mark Tepper. Good morning. Question for
hey,
you.
Hey, Mark,
mentioned,
how are you?
I'm good. You just mentioned recession, and I'm curious, like, what you expect for next year, because one of the key things I look at is you know, obviously the yield curve. Most people look at the 2-year, 10-year. I'm looking at the 3-month 10-year, which is pretty severely inverted, and it's predicted 12 yes. out of the last 11 recessions, which means there's only been one false positive. And I tend to be in the camp that, you know, I don't want to fight that data. I feel like within 6 months, we will be in a worse place than we are right now. We will be in a recession. What's your take, Art?
Well, let me first do the 12 out of the past 11 recessions. You don't want to fight the data. I understand that. But the reason that there were 12 instead of only 11 is because the policies of Reagan change that one that was going to be a recession into not being a recession. In other words, policies can affect things, and they really can. And as it is right now with my expectations about this administration's policies, I see us to secularly decline. It's what I call the Japanification of America.
Yeah.
We are now becoming one of the slow growth countries, just eaten up by our own. Look at the debt levels to GDP. That's just a very bad sign. You know, when you look at the inflation, there's nothing that has been done so far that gets me to change my mind about inflation. Now, we may have some nice inflation numbers for a month, 2 months, 6 months, but the underlying problem of the Fed's balance sheet, of the causing people not to work, all of that, we're going to have more money and less goods, and that is an inflationary environment. And then you look at all the other policies, tax policies. I mean, hiring 87,000 new IRS agents for $80 billion, that's all negative for growth. That's negative for prosperity. So I'm very concerned about next year, and I would say it's going to be a very slow growth year.
Yeah, all great points. Here's Batya.
Hi, Batya Unger-Sargon from Newsweek. I guess my question is, you know, the housing market, right? It's impossible for first-time homeowners now. Wages are up 5%, but inflation eating all of that away. I mean, we're overseeing the death of the American dream here. What is your response to that? What can we say to working-class Americans? Where should they be looking to for hope for getting that American dream back on track?
Yeah, I would not use the word death. I mean, we've been through this death a number of times, and the economy comes back. It's all based on policies. And once you get the policies mix done, and I hope it's during the next 2 years the Republicans learn their lesson and they go back to being the stewards of the economy. If there's one thing a Republican is supposed to do is have a good economy, green eye shades, low taxes, spending restraints, sound money, minimal regulations, free trade. That should be the Republican agenda. Once that happens, we can come back to prosperity. But we've gone through long periods of very dark periods and come back strong. So that's where I think we are right now.
Yeah.
And I don't think the new home buyers have much of an opportunity.
Well, we'll see if the Republicans could stop reckless spending. I mean, that's, you know, because I would say the root cause of this spiking inflation is the COVID relief package, $1.9 trillion signed into law in March of 2021. And the spending just
very
took
true.
Off from there.
And then it will build back better. The little one, all of these are there. Now he's asking for more money for Ukraine.
Yeah.
We're asking more money for COVID-19 relief. There's no end in sight to
yeah.
their wanting to spend
Art,
other people's money.
Great to see you today. Thanks very much.
Well, this economy is in doldrums. Anyway, it's in recession. Anyway, coming up is a overview of FTX. I found a really good overview on Wall Street Week. But here we go with that overview, and it'll sort of help our listening audience understand a little bit better what's going on at FTX. And then I'll have a click-off that really drills down. The Flyover Group did a real comprehensive report on it, and I'll list that up on my website, thesecrettruth.com. You can go in there and listen to that hour-and-a-half program. But here we go with what FTX, what has happened, what's going on.
Over $150 billion. In 3 days, that's how much the world's 15 largest cryptocurrencies lost in market value. It's because of the crypto exchange platform FTX, which is behind this token, named FTT. On November 6th, the token's value began to fall, losing more than 80% of its worth in the span of 72 hours. Once seen as a survivor in a struggling market, the fall of FTX has sent shockwaves through the cryptocurrency industry. So, what went wrong?
FTX is the brainchild of Sam Bankman-Fried. He's commonly known as SBF on social media. He's been previously hailed as a savior of the crypto industry.
And you were called the J.P. Morgan of crypto.
Yep.
Does that bother you or did not?
It doesn't bother me too much.
Bankman-Fried founded the quantitative trading firm Alameda Research in 2017. 2 years later, he started FTX, an exchange platform for buying or selling cryptocurrencies. Right now, he's the majority owner of both firms.
That kind of aroused some skepticism among industry players and traders, investors, stakeholders, that there could be some sort of conflict of interest in terms of whether Alameda Research was getting preferential treatment on FTX, vice versa. But the official narrative that SBF gave in the past is that the two companies are separate entities.
After its launch, FTX attracted major investments from Silicon Valley and Wall Street.
You know, we'd raised a few billion dollars over the course of the last couple of years, and we're a profitable business.
It grew into the fourth largest cryptocurrency exchange for derivatives trading. Celebrities promoted the platform in ads.
I'm getting into crypto
with FTX. You in?
It's FTX. It's a safe and easy way to get into crypto.
Yeah, I don't think so.
FTX was gaining steam, and in the process, often tussled with Binance, the world's largest crypto exchange by volume.
When FTX was getting started, Binance invested in FTX, and it was one of the crypto exchange's earliest investors. But FTX, as we know, grew really rapidly and became a very substantial rival to Binance.
As FTX grew in the industry, Bankman-Fried furthered his reputation as a crypto savior when digital asset prices collapsed earlier this year.
It's not fair to customers.
He bailed out firms, spending about $1 billion.
It's okay to do a deal that is moderately bad in bailing out a place.
But that image didn't last. On November 2nd, CoinDesk published a report based on a leaked Alameda balance sheet. According to the leaked data, Alameda claimed it had over $14 billion in assets at the end of June. But most of that was FTX's tokens. Alameda CEO Caroline Ellison tweeted that the balance sheet wasn't complete.
Caroline also said its financial situation is under control, the company is doing well. However, it seems like the market just didn't really buy that, and then traders continued to withdraw from FTX.
FTX and Alameda did not respond to a request for comment. Things escalated on November 6th when Binance said it would offload hundreds of millions of dollars of FTT. Binance did not respond to a request for comment. The announcement sparked mass withdrawals. That day, FTX processed $4 billion of transactions, many times the normal amount for a day. Some got backlogged, which sparked demand for more. By November 7th, that number ballooned to $6 billion. On the 8th, a day later, FTX's finances were in crisis. Binance stepped in and said it would buy the company. It seemed like FTX might have solved its liquidity problem. But on the 9th, Binance backed out of the non-binding acquisition. The next day, the Journal reported that FTX used money from customers to fund risky bets made by Alameda.
It's a shocking revelation for a lot of people in the industry because even though there has been a lot of speculation about FTX and Alameda Research being joined at the hip, nobody could have foreseen that SBF was willing to transfer billions of customer funds at his crypto exchange to help his crypto trading firm.
The Securities and Exchange Commission and Justice Department are investigating FTX, according to a person familiar with the matter.
This is not like the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. They take people's money, they borrow against it, it's not much disclosure, and then they trade against their customers.
A spokesperson for the Justice Department declined to comment. Bankman-Fried told investors that FTX couldn't cover withdrawals since its collateral was dropping in value and couldn't be liquidated, according to people familiar with the matter. On the 11th, Bankman-Fried resigned as CEO, and FTX and Alameda filed for bankruptcy. Afterwards, FTX said it was probing a potential hack. More than $370 million worth of crypto funds appeared to be missing, according to crypto analytics firm Elliptic. On the 12th, the Journal reported that Alameda and FTX executives knew that FTX had lent its customers money to Alameda.
So a lot of retail traders and investors I've talked to are feeling desperate or frustrated. The majority of the people in the industry could not have seen this coming because FTX is such a dominant player.
The fallout has led other companies to tout their reserves and call for more transparency in the industry. As of November 11th, according to the bankruptcy filing, FTX's estimation of their liabilities would make it the largest crypto-related bankruptcy ever filed.
So there was billions of dollars thrown away, wasted, lost, misinvested, whatever. And so it's going to be a big mess. There's a special trustee taking over. I believe he's in bankruptcy right now, bankruptcy court. But they're trying to figure out in the Bahamas how he put some money in some kind of cold accounts. And I think Bahama government wants to grab hold of some of that or whatever. But anyway, they're debating now how to handle even those monies that were, put in these trustee type of accounts. But anyway, this is going to be a big mess. Greg Reis with a really good report. And he gets into some really important things. So listen closely to Greg Reis. Here we go with Greg Reis coming up.
The people of Brazil are united together in protest against the globalist Great Reset. In 2017, Luiz Lula was convicted on charges of corruption and money laundering and sentenced to 9 years in prison. In April of last year, he was released by the Brazilian Supreme Court to run against Bolsonaro. He is supported by the World Economic Forum. Translating.
Lula was not elected. Lula stole my vote, stole from my people. We will not create war. We will not spill blood. We will fight with peace, this son of a Alexandre de Moraes, because he stole our votes and gave them to another criminal, Lula. They reversed his sentence in order to win, criminally, by stealing and diverting our votes. This was dishonesty, shadiness, criminal. In my country, there is no place for them.
End translation. Alexandre de Moraes is the minister of the Supreme Court of Brazil, who just ordered the banks to block the accounts of anyone supporting the historic protest. If people all over the world took to the streets like the people of Brazil, then the imminent global tyranny would be eradicated. And this is why the media ignores it. They are hoping you just stay home and watch it, like a movie, until it arrives at your front door and it's too late.
Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope. Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line.
Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reis.
They're demonstrating down in Brazil by the millions. And they believe that the election was stolen from them. And they could very well be right. I just don't know how it's going to shake out. In the end, I hope that Bolsonaro comes back in and regains the presidency, but I don't know. There's great chaos down there, and but there's millions of followers that are demonstrating on his behalf. So that remains to be seen. Coming up next is David Rubenstein has written a book recently. It's a brand new book, and it's about how to invest. He went out and interviewed some of the top investors in the institutional markets, and he was interviewed by Maria Bartiromo, and they did mention in there about halfway through the interview about Moderna. And then in that book, I ordered a copy, and I have the book, and he says that it was miraculous that Moderna developed their vaccine in 2 days. I just don't believe that was the case. And in fact, Moderna, by some people's opinions, has been very detrimental in many ways. You got to look into this, get down into Dr. McCullough, and really research this stuff, Dr. Tenpenny, and so forth. But anyway, coming up next is the interview with David Rubenstein and Maria Bartiromo. And by the way, I'm going to follow that with an official at BARDA, and she's going to explain what BARDA is. BARDA is who actually developed the vaccine. And then they gave it out to Pfizer and Moderna to actually start manufacturing. But anyway, I'll put this little BARDA clip up there next after the Rubenstein interview. But here we go with this interview.
Welcome back. Futures are indicating a decline at the start of trading. Take a look at where we are. We are now at the lows of the morning. The Dow Industrials down 342 points right now. The S&P is down 46 and the Nasdaq lower by 150. The Federal Reserve's final meeting of the year kicks off next month. That's December 13 and 14. Federal Reserve President James Bullard says that the Fed needs to continue raising rates by at least another full percentage point. Comes after the Fed's previous four straight 75 basis point hikes. We're going to talk about the macro story right now, investing in it. Joining me right now is the co-founder of the Carlyle Group. He's the author of the new book, How to Invest, Masters on the Craft. Author David Rubenstein is here. David, it's great to see you.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I love this book, and I know you know a lot of these guys just from your own personal life and doing business with them, but you sat down with them to talk about a specific issue, investing, allocating capital in what has really been an uncertain macro story. So let's start there. What are your thoughts on where we are right now? Assess the macroeconomic backdrop.
I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we have to go into a recession. I think most experts would say that probably next year it's likely we'll go into recession, but nobody knows for certain. Depends on what the Fed does. If the Fed increases rates 50 basis points in December, it's not a foregone conclusion that will push us into a recession. Go up 75 basis points, perhaps, or 100 basis points, we could. It depends on what the Fed does. We might have a soft landing, but it depends on the Fed.
Well, I mean, look, the IMF has already taken their global growth number down, talking about the economic outlook getting gloomier on the global stage after predicting growth will slow to 2.7%. Thomas Honig is a regular on this program. He is the former president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve. And he said to me, there's also the Fed's unwind of the balance sheet. And you're talking about, what, $95 billion a month that they want to unwind and not continue this buying of securities. What does that mean in terms of liquidity? You're taking out $1 trillion of liquidity in the year. Do you think that's going to create a disruption for the market?
It'll have some impact, but I don't know that it will have an impact that will lead us into a recession necessarily. Right now, inflation numbers are coming down. The budget looks like it's in reasonable shape. The deficit's coming down. So I would say if the Fed keeps ratcheting up interest rates, it's likely to give us a recession. But if they kind of moderate what they're doing, it might not.
Okay. So let's talk about investing in this environment then, allocating capital. Who did you lean on in terms of getting the best ideas in this book? And I bet you probably took away some little gems of ideas that even maybe you didn't know about, given the level of people you've spoken with.
Well, they're all very smart people, and they all have certain things in common. The most common thing they have in together is that they all defy conventional wisdom. The great investors all say, I'm not going to go with the conventional wisdom, and they've all proven themselves to be right. They also tend to be very smart, math-oriented. They like to make decisions. They tend tend to be people that can get over mistakes and go on to the next thing pretty quickly. They don't just linger with their mistakes forever and just hold on to them. If they make a mistake, they realize that they go on to the next thing. They all are tend to be pretty strong type A personalities, and they all tend to come from reasonably blue-collar families or lower-middle-class families, not from upper-income families.
You also touch on a number of different investing strategies. You've got distressed debt. You've got long-only. You've got short. What kind of approaches do you think work best?
Well, clearly, there are different types. I say there's mainstream, which is stocks and bonds and long-only. There's alternatives, which is private equity and so forth. And there's the new things that I've called the cutting edge, which is like cryptocurrencies or ESG or things that now are more risky, let's say. And I would say none is perfect, and you don't know which one is going to actually work any given time. But the best thing to do, and I'd like to recommend to average person, the average person should not try to be a great investor. If you have a day job, if you're a doctor or a dentist, don't think you're going to be Warren Buffett. That's not likely to happen.
Yeah.
Probably go into an index fund and just call it a day. If you really want to learn how to invest, put the time into it and the energy into it. And I encourage people to go into investing because I think it's a good profession. And I think it makes very good things for America. For example, the venture capital capitalists that put money in Moderna did a good thing for our country, made Moderna a really strong, viable company, and look what they did for vaccines. So I think investors do a good thing for our country by allocating capital the right way, and I think people should look at investors as doing something productive for our country.
Which is why I believe that sharing intellectual property and making it available to everybody is wrong, because what you have in the Moderna situation is somebody who had the courage to take the risk, to invest in a situation, and look what it yielded. Now, if an investor says, well, I'm not really going to get any benefit from this, I don't know that I'll ever see any yields from this because everybody has the same intellectual property, then maybe they won't invest.
You're right. And so what's made America great, among other things, is that we have an incentive to invest and get the benefits of that. And that's what made our country, I think, work pretty well. Moderna is a classic example of that.
Yeah. So you mentioned crypto. What do you think of crypto?
If you go to Las Vegas and you like to gamble, you know you're going to lose money.
Yeah.
So if it gives you pleasure to gamble, okay, so take the amount of money you're happy to lose, fine. In crypto, you know, maybe it's the same thing. If you like to watch the oscillations up and down and tell your friends about how much money you're making or how interesting it is, fine. But you know you're probably going to lose that. So if that is okay with you and you're losing some money, okay. Generally, it's a very complicated area. It's not for, I would say, people who are not professionals. I think the industry is not going to go away because there are a lot of people around the world who are still going to invest in this. Even if FTX has all the problems it has and other companies have problems, it's not going to go away overnight. It's just not going to, in my view.
But do you see a contagion issue here? I mean, you know, crypto trading platform FTX bankrupt, now facing class action lawsuit by investors claiming the company violated Florida law, made consumers suffer more than $11 billion in damages. You've got celebrities on the hook, Tom Brady, Stephen Curry, Shaq O'Neal, all listed in that suit. Should we be worried about this beyond just the crypto holder and the crypto?
Well, we should be worried because it's very risky and it's very complicated, and people don't have the information they would have if it was properly regulated. It really isn't regulated, and so it's the Wild West to some extent. But I don't think it's going to completely go away because there's going to be some interest around the world in this kind of a currency which nobody knows you have. So, for example, if you have your assets taken away, if you're a Russian oligarch, your assets are taken away, people around the world would say, well, I don't want my assets taken away if my country invades Taiwan, for example. So some wealthy Chinese people might say, I want to have some things in assets that nobody can know I have, and then nobody can take them away. So I don't think it's going to go away completely, but clearly it's been damaged a great deal, and a lot of people are going to be suffering from this.
Yeah, and we're going to keep an eye on that one. You're in Washington. You have always been a student of what's going on in terms of political and how it is married to the economic subjects. What are your thoughts on what just took place in the midterms, and do you expect policy to change? You know, policy matters, as you obviously know very well. What is the result of these midterm elections in your view?
Well, obviously there was some surprise. I think it was expected to be a red wave, and it turned out not to be a red wave. I suspect that the House won't get very much done because there's not going to be enough support on one side or another to get anything done. The Senate is going to be divided, probably almost 50-50, so not going to do that much. There's not a lot of spending room right now. We don't have a lot of money because the deficit is pretty big and the debt is pretty big. I think that there's going to be a lot of treading water, and there'll be a lot of the The only things they're going to pass are appropriation bills, debt limit bills, things that we have to pass in order to keep the government running. I don't think you're going to see any major legislation the next 2 years.
David, is that a good thing for markets and the economy?
Well, it's not necessarily a terrible thing because we want to keep the debt and the deficit down. And I think right now Washington could use some diversion from other things. I don't think we need to have the big fights we've had in the last couple of years, last decade or so. So I think it's not a bad thing. And obviously we'll see people already running for president. So that will continue for next 2 years.
All right, final word here. How to Invest, Masters on the Craft is the book. What was the most important takeaway, an idea that you took away that you didn't even know about before you spoke with all of these people?
I think the most important thing is that you really have to prepare. Know what you're doing. You just can't get lucky. If you think you're going to get lucky, you're going to lose a lot of money. Prepare, do the research, know what you're doing, and have some self-confidence in what you're doing. And if you make a mistake, admit it right away and go on to the next thing.
Yeah, be flexible enough to do that. And my one highlight over years and years of seeing various cycles is if it looks too good to be true.
It is true.
It probably is.
It's not going to happen.
Exactly.
Nothing is that great.
David, it's good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
And next coming up is the BARDA official on the staff of that organization. And it just looks like that they're one of the developers of these vaccines. That's what I'm getting from a lot of different sources. But anyway, that's in my opinion, I believe I should say, that I'm gathering up a lot of information that would point in that direction. So here we go with this BARDA clip.
Hello, I'm Christine Oshansky, and I'm a scientist at BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. When a new health security threat emerges, BARDA is ready. We maintain a mission-ready response posture that allows us to mobilize quickly to help save lives. We achieve this through a combination of developing new medical countermeasures, including platform technologies, and manufacturing capacity before an event happens. Ensuring developed products can be deployed and used, and having rapid response capabilities that can quickly pivot to develop, manufacture, and distribute current and new countermeasures in response to a specific public health emergency. Responding to COVID-19 or another emerging infectious disease, or a chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear threat, starts long before the emergency begins. BARDA continuously evaluates its portfolio and identifies and executes on opportunities to address gaps in response capabilities, such as threats for which no countermeasure exists or for which one exists but with limited capabilities. During the development process, BARDA works to ensure that products can be rapidly deployed in response to an emergency. For example, improving cold chain requirements or verifying use capability in all target populations. Since our inception, BARDA has been called upon to respond to multiple threats, including influenza, Ebola, Zika, COVID-19, and other public health emergencies. The products we develop have been used both nationally and globally. As we move forward, we look to enhance our current medical countermeasure portfolio and response capabilities, developing countermeasures against a broader array of threats with improved operational capabilities, more threat-agnostic products, increased and improved flexible domestic manufacturing capacity, streamlined acquisition approaches to expedite funding of development and procurement, and finally, improving access through new collaborations, broader testing, and incorporation of new technologies that allow easier delivery to point of need. You'll find much more in the 2022 BARDA Strategic Plan.
Alex is up next, and he's going to say the kill zone is all everywhere. And he's been right on top of so many things. But here we go with Alex, and he's going to give us some really good insights. Here we go with Alex Jones.
I'm Alex Jones, radio and television host here in Austin, Texas. You're going to see a picture of treason, a picture of the loss of sovereignty of our nation, the United States of America, not by accident, but by design.
We're short of workers. We have a population that is not reproducing it on its own with the same level that it used to. The only way we're going to have a great future in America is if we welcome and embrace immigrants, the Dreamers and all of them, because our ultimate goal is to help the Dreamers but get a path to citizenship for all 11 million or however many undocumented there are here.
It's the Cloud and Piven strategy, America destroyed by design. And the longer this goes, the worse it's going to get until things completely collapse. Then they're going to roll out the national ID cards, the implantable chips. It's all been announced. And you're going to have to do everything they say or they're going to put you in a death camp.
G20 country has agreed to have this digital certificate using WHO standard. So hopefully for the next pandemic, we can still see some movement of the people, some movement of the goods, and movement of the economy.
It's going to be high-tech compact cities, death camps, combat robots, and they're just going to snap their fingers and turn the 5G on, and you'll all start dying of cancer within months. All of these platforms are multi-use. You can modulate 5G and these other systems, and they're good for communications, and they still have major cancer-causing effects of incrementally hitting you from dozens of different angles with different soft-kill weapons so that there's lots of different symptoms, lots of different illnesses, lots of different forms of death. But the life expectancy everywhere these systems go in is plunging. The IQs are plunging. The cognitive ability is plunging. The neurological disorders are exploding. And the heart problems. You have to understand, this kill grid's going in. They didn't just hit us with the COVID-19 out of the lab. They are then able to test and gauge the public and see if you wake up and see if you get upset and see if they can normalize a 40%+ death rate in every Western country previous to any other year. If you look at Latin America until the 1960s, until the IMF and World Bank funded leftist revolutions down there, half of the countries in Latin America had a standard of living close to the U.S. Another 20 or so percent were on par, and about 30% of Latin America had a higher standard of living than we do. Beautiful cities, beautiful farms in rural areas, very low crime. But culturally, they had the same thing done to them that's been done to us. So when you look at the IMF and World Bank, they're just front groups for large private central banks that also own the private Federal Reserve, and you see them with Build Back Better and collapsing our economy and shipping in drugs and all of this. So they've already tested it in other countries, cutting off resources, starting civil wars, poisoning people, doing all this. And now they're taking everything they've learned, this is important, to the Western world.
Then we can start to build back better than before.
But it is undoubtedly an opportunity for us to work together and build back better.
Build back better.
Four sets of priorities can guide the response to build back better.
And build back better than before.
And the globalists say people have air conditioning, they have cars. Remember, Obama went to Africa right before he left office 7 years ago and said, you can't have cars or air conditioning.
If everybody's raising living standards to the point where everybody's got a car and everybody's got air conditioning and everybody's got a big house, well, the planet will boil over.
Well, they look at the West, and the globalists see us as using their resources. They own us, they believe. They've taken control through fraud. And they say, well, we've already been attacking the third world for a long time. Now it's time to make sure no one has anywhere to run and there's no example of freedom and liberty and upward mobility and consumerism. This authoritarian model is coming in. So they have to get rid of the West so it's not an example to aspire to. So they have a really out of control, long-term strategic operation that's now going from being cloaked to uncloaked. But you notice now it starts slow, but it starts accelerating over time. And so now we're moving pretty quick. And in 5 years, we'll be going 10 times faster. But this is the reality. They stated there's too many people. They say they want to kill you. And they then say, hey, look, you're dumb. You don't care. We're going to kill you. I've had globalists try to get me to go over their side. They say, Jones, you're not going to stop us. You should just join us. The public needs to go. Now, do you really want to go, folks?
The next clip, two clips I have is Josh Hawley questioning Mayorkas, head of the Department of Homeland Security, on a secret organization. Actually, they blew the lid off of it a few months ago, but evidently they're putting it back together, and some whistleblowers are providing Josh Hawley and other people some really insightful documents about what this new enterprise that Mayorkas and them are putting together. And it looks like a total interception of, you know, censorship and go after, go get them site, you know, organization. And then the second clip, will be, Josh Hawley questioning the FBI, director, but both are really insightful. Here's the first one with Josh Hawley questioning Mayorkas.
Senator Hawley, you're recognized for your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thanks again to the witnesses for being here. Mr. Secretary, nice to see you. I didn't get to visit with you last time, so let's start with you. I think my colleagues have established, given what we're seeing on the southern border, the massive increase in illegality there, that's clearly not a priority for your agency. So let's talk about what appears to be, and that is spying on Americans and censoring their speech. You have turned your agency into a censorship machine. Now, you said earlier this year that you disbanded the Disinformation Governance Board, which I thought was totally unconstitutional, but that turns out to be at best misleading. That's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what you're doing. Your own quadrennial review, which was just reported in the press, says that disinformation is going to be the new focus at DHS. The quad review says that DHS plans to target, I'm quoting now, inaccurate information domestically on a wide array of subjects, including, quoting, the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, the efficacy of COVID-19 vaccines, racial justice, U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the nature of U.S. support for Ukraine. This is what you're devoting your agency's resources to. So I guess my first question is an American citizen who criticizes COVID mandates now to be treated as a domestic terrorist?
Of course not, and I'd like to say three things since you have three inaccuracies in the question you posed to me. Number one, border security is a priority of ours. Number two, the department does not censor speech. And number three, we did not publish a quadrennial review.
Does it exist, the quadrennial review?
I believe it is being worked on.
Well, it's been published in the media. Will you make it public?
When it is final, it will be public.
Mr. Chairman, without objection, I'd like to enter this article called The Truth Cops, published in The Intercept. Here's my question, then. If you're not censoring speech and if you're not treating Americans as domestic terrorists, then why is it that you're pressuring big tech to treat American citizens as if they're threats to the homeland? Why are you pressuring them to censor speech? Let's take a look at some new documents that have come to light that show what your administration is doing, this administration is doing to censor speech. Let's take a look at this email from July 16th, 2021. It's over my shoulder here. Facebook emailing HHS saying, I know our teams met today to better understand the scope of what the White House expects from us on misinformation going forward. Are you familiar with that email?
No.
Let's try another one.
And if I should.
How about, hold on. We'll get to that. You're not familiar with this. All right. Let's try a different one. Here's one from July 20th, 2021. The White House emails Facebook saying, any way we can get this pulled down. 46 seconds later, Facebook responds, yep, we're on it. Are you familiar with that email?
No.
Okay. How about this one? July 23rd, 2021. Facebook employee writes to HHS, says, thank you for taking the time to meet today. Wanted to make sure you saw the steps we took just this past week to adjust policies and what we are removing with respect to misinformation. Are you familiar with that one?
Senator, we do not instruct.
Just yes or no.
No, because I'm the Secretary of DHS.
Well, I'm asking you that because it's funny you say that. A federal judge has just found as a finding of fact, Mr. Secretary, that your office, and I'm going to quote now, is supervising the nerve center of federally directed censorship. It's a federal judge and a federal lawsuit. You are supervising the nerve center of federally directed censorship. Here's another email, August 20th, 2021. Facebook writes again to HHS and highlights that Facebook is increasing the strength of our demotions for COVID and vaccine-related content. April 16th, 2021, Rob Flaherty at the White House circulates a Zoom meeting invitation to Twitter employees stating White House staff will be briefed by Twitter on vaccine misinformation. We have example after example of this administration coordinated, apparently, according to a federal court, by your agency, pressuring, coercing social media companies to engage in censorship. Is that constitutional?
That is unequivocally false.
Is what the emails show?
It is unequivocally false, Senator.
You are not pressuring the big tech companies to take down accounts. You are not meeting with them to ask them to censor on your behalf.
That is correct. We are not.
You're not having any meetings with them whatsoever.
We meet with the tech companies.
How often?
To address the Homeland Security mission.
How often do you meet with them?
For example, online child sexual exploitation is a scourge in this country, and we have an obligation to address it.
You're saying that no one in your office has ever met with, coordinated, or otherwise engaged in any contact with a social media company in which you spoke to them about vaccine mandates, about COVID mask mandates, about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, about the current U.S. involvement in Ukraine. None of that has ever happened.
I don't know what you're referring to, Senator, and I can
read the emails.
And I can tell you this. Well, you've actually cited emails outside of our department. But if
I've cited a federal judge who says your department is engaged in supervising the nerve center of federally directed censorship. Here's my point, Mr. Secretary. It has been established for years in this country, as you very well know because you're a lawyer, that the federal government may not use private third parties to engage in activities that are unconstitutional. That's exactly what you and this administration are doing. You are leveraging private companies to carry out censorship on your behalf. It's dystopian, but worse than that, it's unconstitutional.
It's also false.
Coming up next is Josh Hawley's questioning of Ray. And especially he gets into a fight that he was making. The last time that Josh Hawley was trying to question him, he said he had to get on a flight, an important flight, and then it was going to on his vacation. But anyway, they get into that. But Josh Hawley is a really stand-up person. So here we go with the second interview. Josh Hawley questioning Director of the FBI, Ray.
Senator Hawley, you're recognized for your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thanks to the witnesses for being here. Director Ray, let me start with you if I could. I think the last time that I got to visit with you was back in August 4th of this year. You were at the Senate Judiciary Committee. You remember that, I assume. We had to cut that hearing short. We were supposed to do two rounds of questions. You said you had to be somewhere, so we cut it short. Republicans were not able to ask a second round as we had been informed we would. The press reported shortly thereafter that the reason that the hearing had to be cut short is because you were flying on a Gulfstream jet for a personal vacation in the Adirondacks. Please tell me that's not accurate.
Senator, the hearing was not cut short from my experience. We had agreed beforehand on the time and length of it, and I was very surprised to find that any man on the committee was surprised. As to how I fly, I am required, not only permitted, but required to fly on an FBI plane wherever I go.
So you were going on vacation?
I was, yes.
So you left a statutorily required oversight hearing in order to go on a personal vacation in the Adirondacks?
I took a flight to go visit my family, as had been previously arranged in conjunction with the leadership of the committee.
The ranking member, Chuck Grassley, asked you during the hearing, he said, I assume you must have other business. You said, yes. He then said, if you have a business trip, you've got your own plane, can't it wait a while? He then said, Chuck Grassley, we only just heard half an hour ago that now you have to leave. We were going to have a 7-minute round followed by a 3-minute round. I've got 7 people on my side of the aisle, that included me, who are waiting for this additional round. Is there any reason we can't accommodate them for 21 minutes? And you said you had a plane to catch. You had somewhere to go. And now we find out it was for vacation?
The reference to other business was not a reference to that day. It was a reference to the following week where Senator Grassley and I were going to see each other in Iowa when I had other business in Iowa, and I did in fact see him then.
So wait, you had to leave the hearing early because you had, you're going to see him later in Iowa in a week?
No, I had to leave when I said I was going to have to leave, as had been previously organized with the leadership of the committee.
You left an oversight hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, required by statute, so you could vacation with your family. I find that absolutely unbelievable and, frankly, indefensible. Now, is it your practice to use government planes? You say you do this all the time. You flew in a Gulfstream 550, I think, that was originally purchased for counterterrorism purposes. You were using it to go to, what is it, Saranac Lake? Is that how I say it? I've never been there. Is that the right pronunciation? Saranac Lake? That was your destination?
Yes.
So, did you enjoy the flight? I mean, did you pay for it?
Yes, I paid for it.
Will you turn over all receipts and reimbursement to this committee?
Senator, we will be happy to comply with oversight requests related to the use of the plane, as I said, and it's important for people to understand.
Why don't you just give me a yes? Will you turn over the receipts?
I will turn over the information related to my use of the plane. The use of the plane, I am required, not just permitted, required, even for personal travel, to use the FBI plane.
How convenient for you.
And I pay every single time that I use the plane for personal
use. I'm glad it's available for you to jet away from your statutorily required hearings and oversight before this Congress, where you denied the ability of members of Congress to ask you questions because you had to go on a personal vacation using a government plane. Let's just look at some of the things while you've been vacationing that your FBI has been doing. According to numerous whistleblowers who have come forward to members of this body, to members of the House, the FBI has been sending more than, in one instance, a dozen armed agents to a rural Pennsylvania home of a Catholic pro-life demonstrator to arrest him at gunpoint in front of his children in early morning hours, despite the fact that he posed no risk of violence or threat and had previously offered to turn himself in. Numerous whistleblowers, field agents, have alleged that D.C., your headquarters, has pulled them off working on child sex abuse cases, working on human trafficking cases, in order to work on January 6th matters for this reason, to give the appearance, they say, that there are hundreds of new domestic terrorism cases in the country, when in fact there are not. Whistleblowers, field agents have also said that D.C. has ordered the use of SWAT teams on nonviolent suspects who may have attended a January 6th rally, and they have been ordered to conduct surveillance and knock on doors of people who were not even in D.C. on January 6th. And again, all of this, according to the whistleblowers, these are your agents, all of this in order to make it look as if there's a mass surge in domestic terrorism all across the country, when in fact the stats are being padded by political directive in your office. They also say, these whistleblowers, the D.C. leadership deliberately suppressed investigations into Hunter Biden, contrary to FBI procedure, and have also retaliated against FBI agents and whistleblowers who have contacted Congress, which, by the way, they are protected by statute to do so. This is what's happening at your FBI while you are evading oversight hearings. Mr. Director, do you think you're still up to this job?
I absolutely think I'm still up to this job, and I think our workforce feels the same way.
Well, I don't. And frankly, I think you should have been gone a long time ago. And given your behavior recently, I think it only makes it more clear. Are there any travel plans today that we should be aware of that you have? We're supposed to have a second round. Will you be here for that?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to end up this first hour with Jay Dyer, and he's going to be speaking about a lot of very, very interesting things. And it's just hard to, it gets back to the power structure, how manipulated we are and so forth. But anyway, we're going to end with Jay Dyer, and you'll be able to, I'll put a click off on my site, The Secret Truth, where you come in and listen to his whole interview, actually his lecture this week. But I'll put that up, and you'll be able to listen to his whole, dissertation. So here we go with Jay Dyer, and then you'll hear the music. We'll be finished. Be out of here.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. I want to remind you, if you notice there on the screen, you'll see that that second box there. I did. It's one of my biggest interviews I've done to date. And that is with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who was Trump's pick for national security advisor. He did
not get that post that was blocked, I think, that involved Mitch McConnell, if I recall. But Colonel McGregor is a frequent guest on Tucker Carlson. You may have seen him or heard of him. And we did a full hour breakdown of everything from the Great Reset to FTX scam token, Sam Bankman-Fried style Federal Reserve stuff, to the Ukraine situation, Russia, et cetera. It was an amazing interview. It's, again, one of the biggest I've done to date. Be sure and go to my YouTube channel and check that out. It's getting a lot of attention, a lot of good feedback. So if you're looking for a deeper breakdown from a high-profile individual, definitely go check that out. And also, I would add, today I'm going to be uploading we had earlier in the last hour, Alex had the children of two of the most famous directors. I just did an interview with one of the other most famous directors, his son, Andrei Tarkovsky Jr. So if you're familiar with Tarkovsky's films, and the amazing art that he put out over the years, films like Stalker, films like Solaris, films like Rublev, sort of capturing the history and the essence of Eurasia and Russia, especially in art and iconography. We went really deep into the breakdown of Andre Jr.'s documentary that he put out. It's now at the Criterion Collection. Cinema Prayer, about his father, about Andrei Tarkovsky. So Tarkovsky, of course, being hugely influential as well in the global film scene, influencing many, many filmmakers in the West, in Hollywood as well. And so you definitely want to check that out. I'll be premiering that on my channel this week as well. It's also already available on my Rockfin channel. So if you're looking for information like that, that's a little edgier, a little sooner than other stuff, you can subscribe to me over on Rockfin. I think Greg Reese is maybe coming over to Rockfin as well. Paul Joseph Watson's on Rockfin too. So a lot of cool stuff over there. You know, we were talking about this scam model, how the scams work. And these scams are structured in the way that a lot of intelligence agencies have structured secrets and cells, secret societies and cells over the years. And so if we think about how, for example, organized crime set up the secret societies that they had, we go back to Sicily in the 1800s, 1700s. This is the origin of the omerta, which is a secret oath, a death oath that you make to your don, to the don of the local. At that time, it was a militia, but the militias are actually the local militias is where we get the idea of the Sicilian mafia. Now, when a lot of the immigrants came over to the U.S., they didn't find a lot of help with the existing local police, so naturally they would continue their model of local neighborhood militia, and that's where we get the ideas of the Don and this kind of stuff. But the Omerta, the secret ritual, which is actually a copy from certain Masonic rituals and Masonic groups out of Italy's known as the Carbonari, the sort of they copied this, and that's because one of the early Italian revolutionaries his name was Garibaldi. He was influenced by Giuseppe Mazzini, who was one of the most famous. There you go. Exactly. This is the Omerta scene in Sopranos, and I'm sure if you've never seen the Sopranos, I highly recommend checking it out because there's a lot of gabagool. Oh, the gabagool. A lot of gabagool, a lot of gumars, and a lot of goombas up in The Sopranos. But it's a great show. We did a whole 2-hour breakdown of that show, by the way, if you're looking for a great podcast, getting into all the really insightful elements in that show, including there's the Omerta right there where you burn the image of the saint and you sort of take a blood oath. But there's also references to, you know, the tie-in with organized crime and intelligence agencies. There's references to the CIA, to Tony having to at times collude with the FBI. All of that comes up in that show consistently throughout. Yeah, I think one of the best TV shows ever made, honestly. But it's instructive, again, because as you heard Vivian, I think, mention in the last hour, you know, the organized crime model is really the best way to understand how the global elites run things. Now, this may sound like, oh, yeah, of course, there's organized crime. Yeah, we all know that. But people just still can't figure out there's this block in their head, this roadblock between there being organized crime and global organized crime. They just cannot figure this out. They cannot figure out that giant pharmaceutical corporations operate like organized crime. They can't figure out that giant international banking institutions operate like organized crime. Now, we just had a giant institution that collapsed. Guess what? It's operating on an organized crime model. And it's not run by nerdy dude with an afro. He's the face of that. He's the front of that. And the front people, they take the fall. And the media right now is running cover for him.